All right, so we are in 2 Samuel chapter 10. 2 Samuel 10, moving along in the life of David, and boy, gleaning a lot of neat things from his life. Now, it says in verse 1 of chapter 10, "It happened after this that the king of the people of Ammon died, and Hanun his son reigned in his place." And so Ammon is looking at present-day Jordan. And David said, "I will show kindness to Hanun the son of Nahash, as his father showed kindness to me." So David sent by the hand of his servants to comfort him concerning his father, and David's servants came into the land of the people of Ammon. Now, David again is sitting in this place now where things really are at a restful place. Things are really at peace. And remember back in chapter 9, it's in that place that he kind of says, you know, "Is there anyone still left in the house of Saul that I can show kindness to?" And sure enough, a servant came and said, "Yeah, there's one, Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan." And we talked about that last week. A great, wonderful story in 2 Samuel 9 that deals with, again, David's kindness, really looking towards God's kindness through Jesus Christ that he showed and displayed to us. So we were hurt by the fall, just like Mephibosheth, broken and lame, unable to help himself. David brings him to the king's table where he will eat continuously forevermore at the king's table, though he's lame. And great picture of us. But here's David now again in chapter 10 going, "Well, you know, I'm going to show kindness. This is feeling good. I like this. I like the feeling of showing kindness. I like what that does for me." And sure enough, you know, when we are those that are walking in kindness and grace, and desiring just to bless others, boy, there it does something to you. There's a kind of a, I think, an energy that comes from that, just a real excitement that comes from that. And so here's David now in chapter 10 going, "Well, all right, this king of Ammon has passed away, and I will show kindness to Hanun the son of Nahash." And he says in verse 2, "just as his father had showed kindness to me." David was one that received kindness. Now, we don't exactly know what was done by Nahash to David, what act of kindness was done. It's not really recorded clearly for us in Scripture, so we're not really sure. But whatever it was an act of kindness that David was really wanting to repay to him and to bless him and to kind of show this now to Hanun, Nahash's son. So he sends people there. David's servants came into the land of the people of Ammon. And now in verse 3, "And the princes of the people of Ammon said to Hanun their lord, 'Do you think that David really honors your father because he sent comforters to you? Has David not rather sent his servants to you to search the city to spy it out and to overthrow it?'" And so they begin to think, you know, this is espionage going on here. This is David and his men coming in to sort of search out the city, kind of see where our weaknesses are, where we're vulnerable, because they're just wanting to really overthrow the city. They're coming in with this, you know, this look and act of, "Well, we just want to bless you. We want to show kindness to you." But these people begin to get a little bit, you know, questionable towards them, critical, thinking, "This isn't right." Therefore, check out verse 4. "Therefore, Hanun took David's servants, shaved off half of their beards, and cut off their garments in the middle at their buttocks, and sent them away." This is crazy stuff. I mean, this is amazing. "And when they told David, he sent to meet them." But, you know, they shave off half their beards, cut their garments right at their buttocks, and send them away. And as they walked off, I mean, there was a full moon that night. And, you know, but, you know, just quite a scene that we see happening here, isn't it? But now, you see, they see these guys coming in, and they're really kind of, you know, questioning what's going on here. They're not receiving this blessing that's coming their way. David's heart was not to do this. So they decide, you know, "We're going to just humiliate these guys." And that's what they're attempting to do, just to humiliate David's men. Now, for, you know, in Israel, every man that was an Israelite would have had a beard. It was kind of a sign of dignity, of masculinity, of manhood. Yeah. Right? Right? So, you know, that's kind of what it represents. Those of you that don't, well, okay, I won't get into it. But so that's kind of what it represented. And it was a real serious thing, you know, for a man to have a beard. More seriously, for him not to have a beard. It was a servant, a slave, that was to be clean shaven. And so it was a distinguishable feature to really show who you were, you know, among the Israelites. and for any man not to have a beard was a very shameful thing. And so, and then also to expose them as they did, cutting off their garments and exposing their, you know, right at the middle of their buttocks, it was and wanting to just expose them. And again, to shame them. They wanted to send them away and just humiliate these guys. I mean, my goodness. Yeah, I know, it's funny, isn't it? But boy, I tell you, the word is good, isn't it? I mean, it just spells it out for you just as it is, you know. Now, when they told David, he went to meet them because the men were greatly ashamed. And the king said, wait at Jericho until your beards have grown and then return. So he says, don't do anything. Just sit back and wait for those beards to grow so that you can come out and not be shamed and humiliated, you know, in this way. And when the people of Ammon saw that they had made themselves repulsive to David, and that's really implying that they had just become like a stench to David and to all of Israel, and they realized it. They realized, oh boy, maybe we pushed things a little too far here. You ever done something with someone where you feel you maybe you've gone a little overboard? I'll tell you, I have lots of times. You know, just goofing around and then you kind of push the envelope and you go, oh boy, I've really become a stench to that person. I've really, you know, done a bad thing. And so this is what they're kind of feeling now. They made themselves repulsive to David. The people of Ammon sent and hired then the Syrians of Beth-Rehob and the Syrians of Zobah, 20,000 foot soldiers, and from the king of Maacah, 1,000 men, and from Ishtob, 12,000 men. And so basically now the people of Ammon are going, you know, we're really in a world of hurt here. And so they begin to hire out mercenaries, 33,000 extra soldiers that they have come to their aid and come to their defense basically from the area up north there around Syria. And so they're bringing in all these reinforcements basically. And 1 Chronicles chapter 19 verse 6 to 7 tells us the expense that it took for them to hire these mercenaries to come and help them in battle. It cost 1,000 talents of silver, which would equal somewhere in the vicinity of close to $6 million in today's dollars. So this was a huge expense that they're putting out because they're going, we're going to otherwise die. So there's no expense that's too great to really spare our lives here. And so they're bringing in the reinforcements. But then when David heard of it, he sent Joab and all the army of the mighty men. Remember, Joab's his kind of his right-hand man, the army general in a sense. And he sends Joab out. And the people of Ammon came out and put themselves in battle array at the entrance of the gate. And the Syrians of Zobah, Beth-Rehob, Ishtob, and Maacah were by themselves in the field. And when Joab saw that the battle line was against him before and behind, he chose some of Israel's best and put them in battle array against the Syrians. And the rest of the people he put under the command of Abishai, his brother, that he might set them in battle array against the people of Ammon. So here we see now, as Joab is coming in with the army of Israel, that the people of Ammon begin to come out, but then the Syrian forces begin to come sort of from the other side to surround them, to kind of box them in a sense. And they're looking just to bring them down, to trap the Israelite army. So Joab says, well, I will take some of the men for myself. And it says in verse 9 that he chose some of Israel's best. You know, of course, you always want the best on your side. And then it says, and the rest of the people he gave, hey, bro, Abishai, you take the rest of the people, okay? I've got the strong ones. But the rest, you know, they'll be some help to you, I think. You know, and so he kind of passes on the rest of the people to Abishai. But what Joab's looking to do is say, let's divide ourselves up. Because if we were to go against the people of Ammon, then we're going to be vulnerable in the rear guard, you know. And of course, it's kind of the slower, weaker people that are sort of hanging back, you know, and not able to keep up. And so they're thinking, if we go up against Ammon, then the people of Syria will come against us from the rear and attack us there. But then if we go against Syria, then we're vulnerable to the people of Ammon. So he says, let's divide ourselves up here. And you go up against the people of Ammon, and I'll go up against the people of Syria. And we'll just go at them head to head, in a sense. And that's what we see happening here. And so in verse 11, then he said to Abishai, his brother, if the Syrians are too strong for me, then you shall help me. But if the people of Ammon are too strong for you, then I will come and help you. And he says, be of good courage and let us be strong for our people and for the cities of our God. And may the Lord do what is good in his sight. This is some real good advice and encouragement that Joab's given here. Though Joab wasn't always a real, you know, godly kind of man and acted in real wisdom, this is certainly some good counsel an encouragement that he's given to Abishai that no doubt the rest of Israel was greatly comforted in here. And it even echoes the words that the Lord had said to Joshua back in Joshua chapter 1, verses 6 and 9. You know, be strong and of good courage. And we can, as Christians, certainly get down and discouraged when we begin to see pressure mounting around us. But, you know, these are times we have to take courage and times where we have to really be strong in the Lord, not in yourself. Because if you begin to look at things through your eyes, then, yeah, you will be weakened and you will be discouraged and down. But if we begin to strengthen ourselves in the Lord, as what Joab is saying here, be of good courage and let us be strong. Be strong in the Lord and in the power of His might. And ultimately, the Lord is fighting the battle for us, and He will do what is good in His sight, Joab says in verse 12 there. He will do what's good in His sight. You know, we certainly need to be active in preparation for the battle, but it's the Lord who will take care of the outcome. And we need to be comfortable and content with that. It may be different than what I had planned. It may be a different outcome than what I was expecting, but that's okay, because God is doing that which is good in His sight. And ultimately, what's good in His sight will be good for me, won't it? It'll be good for you. So regardless of what happens, I don't need to take the blame of a setback if I've been diligent in stepping out faithfully, nor can I be one that takes credit for the victory, because it's the Lord that's going before me. And it's the Lord who will do what is good in His sight. He is the one who is leading and fighting on my behalf. And so I can take comfort in that. And you can take comfort in that. God will do that which is good in His sight. We need to let Him go before us and fight those battles for us. And be strong in the Lord. Be courageous. Because we're not alone in those things. So Joab and the people who were with him drew near for the battle against the Syrians, and they fled before him. And when the people of Ammon saw that the Syrians were fleeing, they also fled before Abishai and entered the city. So Joab returned from the people of Ammon and went to Jerusalem. And when the Syrians saw that they had been defeated by Israel, they gathered together. Then Hadadezer sent and brought out the Syrians who were beyond the river, and they came to Helam, and Shobak, the commander of Hadadezer's army, went before them. And when it was told David, he gathered all Israel, crossed over the Jordan, and came to Helam. And the Syrians set themselves in battle array against David and fought with him. And then the Syrians fled before Israel, and David killed 700 charioteers and 40,000 horsemen of the Syrians, and struck Shobak, the commander of the army, who died there. And when all the kings who were servants to Hadadezer saw that they were defeated by Israel, they made peace with Israel and served them. So the Syrians were afraid to help the people of Ammon anymore. So what we see happening here is that the people of Ammon, when they began to see that Joab and his guys were taking on the Syrians and the Syrians were retreating, then the people of Ammon said, well, we're getting out of here too. And they went and kind of took refuge in the city of Rabbah, kind of the main city of Ammon. And where we will eventually meet up with them again here at the end of chapter 12. But however, the Syrians were not really going down without a fight. So they mustered up their troops again, they bring in the reinforcements, and they come against David and Israel once more. And so David, you know, being a true leader, he leads the people out in battle. I like that. I like that, you know, David is one that said, I'm going, just follow me. Just as, you know, our Savior, the Son of David, is one who says, just follow me. I've gone before you. I'm not asking you to do anything that I myself haven't done. Isn't that wonderful? That we serve a Savior who knows the things that we've been through, who knows what we're going through because He's been there Himself. And He just says, follow along with me. And David is exemplifying this. And again, God is blessing David. I mean, we see the borders of Israel expanding. And really, David goes down as in history as the greatest leader for Israel. And we see the borders of Israel expanded to their greatest under David's reign. But in this period now of success and victory, things seemingly going well, we also see that David becomes very vulnerable. And we need to be careful in those times where we feel that everything is indeed going well, where we feel strong and think that we're impenetrable. It's in those times where we begin to relax a little bit. Maybe we're perhaps not depending on the Lord as much as we were when we really did need Him, when we were really crying out to the Lord. It's in those periods of peace and even victory where we kind of think, oh man, things are going well. I can just kind of, you know, put it in cruise control now. And it's at these times where the enemy looks to really come and throw those fiery darts and hit us in those areas where our guard is down a little. This is what we'll see with David now as we move into the next chapter. And Paul would say this in 2 Corinthians 12, verse 10, that I take pleasure in infirmities, in reproaches, in needs, and in persecutions, in distresses, for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, I am strong. Paul realized that it's in my period when I'm really depending on the Lord, where I feel weak, then I'm really strong, because I'm not relying then on myself. I'm not thinking that everything is just hunky-dory, everything's okay. It's in my periods of weakness and infirmities, persecutions and distress, where I'm really turning to the Lord, saying, God, I need you. But he would say, it's when I'm weak, then I am strong. And that's the way it is for us. Now, we finished the first section of 2 Samuel after getting through chapter 10 here. Really divide up into two sections here. Chapters 1 and 10 looks at the triumphs of David. But then as we move into chapter 11 now, we begin to look at the troubles of David. The second chapter, the second section of 2 Samuel. It's as though in chapter 11, David indeed files for chapter 11, spiritually speaking. You know, definition for chapter 11 is a debtor is declared bankrupt, but is allowed reorganization to attempt debt repayment. And truly, David will hit an all-time low, but God will allow him to continue on because David has that repentant heart. He has that, he's a man who has a heart after God. And it will be a time where David can indeed continue to be used to the Lord, but there will be some bumps along the way. So as we get into chapter 11, really this chapter is summarized by this statement, rooftop risk, romance, and rebuke requiring repentance. So let's look at chapter 11. It happened in the spring of the year, at the time when kings go out to battle, that David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel, and they destroyed the people of Ammon and besieged Rabbah, but David remained at Jerusalem. Well, that's interesting right there. You know, just as we have hockey season, which I'm very grateful for, and football season and hunting season. Yeah, a few amens for hockey season. But, you know, hunting season, all the lakes. In this day, they had a season where they would go to war. It was war season. And it was, as we see, in the spring of the year, at the time when kings would go into battle. You know, things would usually start up again in the spring. They'd kind of take a little bit of a reprieve in the wintertime as things would get colder and the weather was not cooperative. They'd be out there with the chariots, they'd get stuck in the mud. And so people said, you know what, it's not worth it. The elements are too crazy. It's just not worth it. We'll take that reprieve in the winter times. But then in the spring, they'd kind of get back at it and engage in battle and in warfare once again. So here David now in the springtime is sending Joab and his men out to finish up the work against the people of Ammon who were there taking refuge, as I said, in the city of Rabbah. But it says that David remained at Jerusalem. You know, here's where the beginning of trouble really started for David. David should have been the one that was leading the campaign. We just finished talking about how David was going forth and being that good leader. But here now he's kind of taking a little bit of a break. He figured he would just take it easy, maybe stay home, put his feet up, you know, have a little glass of iced tea, whatever it was. But David is deciding, I'm going to take a break here. You know, we often find it tempting to point the finger at people who do things that they shouldn't do. But it's just as bad to not do what we should be doing. This is the case with David here. You know, he should have been doing something, but he didn't. And James 14 says, therefore, to him who knows to do good and does not do it, to him it is sin. And sometimes not doing what we should do may not be a necessary sin in and of itself, but it may be the catalyst for sin. As we will see, that will be the case here in chapter 11. And we'll see how this was the case, definitely, here with David. So look at verse 2. It happened one evening that David arose from his bed and walked on the roof of the king's house. And from the roof, he saw a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful to behold. So David's out strolling on the rooftop. Now, again, in our minds and in our culture, you kind of look at this and go, man, he's a pervert. He's kind of like being a peeping Tom up on the rooftop. Man, who's up on the rooftop looking at people? But again, in this day, they had their houses designed where, you know, the rooftops were flat. That would oftentimes become like their patio, even their garden area. And so it's very common for people to go up on the rooftop and enjoy, you know, the cool breeze of evening. And that's what David's doing here. But it's as he's up there strolling along the rooftop that he spots this woman who's bathing there as well. Now, this word saw, he saw a woman bathing, implies that he was gazing at her. He didn't just kind of, you know, up there walking along, all of a sudden, what's going on? It was that he kind of looks, sees, and is contently gazing and looking at what he's seeing. And that begins to be the problem. You see, it's not wrong to see something that's not good. The question is, what do you do after that initial look? And instead of turning away, David began to entertain that thought. And this is where you begin to get into trouble. This is where temptation begins to move into sin. No doubt David was being tempted. Being tempted is not wrong. Having that look all of a sudden where you accidentally catch something is not wrong. But the minute you begin to indulge that temptation or that look, begin to gaze upon it, then that's where it begins to enter into a whole other realm, an area of sin. You know, there's another man from the Old Testament who was put in an awkward situation like this. His name was Joseph. We all know the story of Joseph. And he had every opportunity to engage in a flesh-filled festivity. But did he stand around and ponder the possibilities? You know, when Potiphar's wife had grabbed a hold of him? Did he sit there and say, you know what, I got to pray about this? No, he didn't. He didn't even stop to say, Lord, help me in this situation. He got out of there and ran away, leaving his cloak, his robe behind even. He got out of there. He said, here's a vulnerable situation. I'm not even going to stick around to see how this plays out. I'm getting out of here. And he fled the scene. Guys, that is a good lesson for us. Because when we come across something that we could be vulnerable to, that could lead to temptation, which then could lead to sin, at the minute that we catch that, we need to go, I'm out of here. I'm going. David, when he catches Bathsheba bathing, should have said, oh, not for me. I'm out of here. I'm getting out of here. You know, lock himself in the room, go have a cold shower, whatever it takes, but get out of there. But he sat there and did what Joseph didn't do. He began to gaze at her. And so David, again, never sinned by seeing Bathsheba. He sinned when he decided to stay and stare. And that's when it entered into sin. And this is just simply playing with fire. Proverbs 6:27 in the New Living Translation says, can a man scoop fire into his lap and not be burned? I like that. Can you scoop fire into your lap and not be burned? We think, you know, oh, I've got a handle on this. But you're just scooping fire into your lamp, into your lap, and you will eventually be burned. It doesn't take much to do a lot of damage. Case in point, I remember a time many years ago, I was hanging out at a friend's cabin down at Point Roberts. And so we went out one evening to the beach. So let's have a little campfire here. So we had the fire going. It was nice and we're hanging out. Well, you know, it was getting kind of late. It was time to go. And so we were very diligent to want to extinguish the fire to put it out. And we began to do what we could to put it out. And we thought, yeah, that looks pretty good. You know, got a handle on that. That's under control. So we went back, you know, and well, the next night or the next day, you know, we got up and went over to the beach and, you know, saw a little bit of a commotion at the beach. And people began to, you know, tell us, man, tell you, the fire department was out here just in huge numbers and big problem on the beach. And we went walking on the beach and noticed that every log on the beach for about 100-yard or 100-foot stretch was completely burned up. This little fire that we had going that we were so careful to put out, well, it eventually began to burn again. One of the embers, all it takes, and it began to spread, and we set the whole beach on fire. I mean, you know, not that we meant to do that. We were trying to be very careful, but it doesn't take much. You put a little, you know, you begin to play with fire, you're going to get burned. Can a man scoop fire in his lap and not get burned? And we thought we had a handle on it, that we were being safe, but it didn't take much for that little ember to begin to erupt in chaos. And so it is in your life where you think, oh, I've got it, you know, all kind of safe and sound, and everything's, you know, fine. I've got a grip on it, I got a handle on it. If you don't put that out properly, I mean, it's going to spread like wildfire, and it will do some damage. We get so blinded to the harm and the consequences of sin, and I think David would have been one that would have run if he had a little insight into the potential problems that one look could have ignited. You know, about that, David Guzik says this: the cost was so much greater than David wanted to consider at the time. If he knew that this one-time pursuit of pleasure would result in an unwanted pregnancy, one man murdered by his command, his baby dead, his daughter raped by his son killed, another son will lead a civil war against him and end up dead, and still another son will imitate his lack of sexual self-control, and it will lead him and all of Israel away from God. All this was a direct or indirect result of this one sin. Imagine that. We think, oh, this isn't going to harm anybody. This isn't going to affect another. Can you imagine if David just all of a sudden got a vision of what that one look could have led to and did lead to? If he could have gotten some insight, some foresight into that, I think he would have said, not worth it, I'm out of here. And we never are willing to count the cost, or at least count the cost accurately. We can kind of look to count the cost and think, it's okay, I can get by with that. The cost will always be greater than you could ever expect or calculate, guys. David surely found that out the hard way. Well, verse 3. So David sent and inquired about the woman. And someone said, is this not Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite? And then David sent messengers and took her. And she came to him, and he lay with her, for she was cleansed from her impurity, and she returned to her house. You know, after hearing the status of Bathsheba, yeah, she's the wife of Uriah the Hittite. She said, all right, hands off. Can't go there. That should have been enough for David. I mean, it should have been enough for him up on the rooftop to say, that's a person up there bathing. I shouldn't be looking at that. It should have been enough. But then finding out now that, you know, after inquiring about her, that she's married to Uriah, who was an important man to David. We'll find out later on that he was one of David's mighty men. Should have said, no way, hands off, can't go down this path. But David then called for her and had her sent. And he's thinking that, well, Uriah, he's, you know, over fighting my wars here. He's out of the picture, so here you go. Bathsheba, why don't you come over? Your husband's not around. Come on over to my place. And he makes his move. And the word is careful to point out that she was cleansed from her impurity, it says, which simply means and indicates that she had just had her menstrual period, and she was not pregnant at this time that she met with David. She was not pregnant. So it's very clear who the one will be here. And sadly, David was one that already had many wives. He's not lonely. He's not craving female companionship. He's simply struggling with lust. And you think, well, if I can just, you know, feed that lust or put things around me that will help me in that, then that would be enough. But the lusts of the flesh are not something that can be satisfied. We need to crucify the flesh and make no provision for the flesh, Paul says in Romans, to fulfill its lusts. The flesh and the lust of the flesh is not something that can be satisfied. Don't ever think that, well, I'm really struggling with this, but if I just get married, then it'll be okay. Or if I just do this, then it'll be okay. No, your flesh and your lust of the flesh will continue to rage. And if it's this you're craving, once you have that, then that flesh will crave something else if you don't deal with the flesh and crucify the flesh and lay it down and die to it. Say, I'm not going to let this reign in my life any longer. I'm not going to let this have its way any longer. David shouldn't have had any need for Bathsheba. But all the wives that he had wasn't enough because he wasn't dealing with that one issue of lust in his life. So the woman conceived, so she sent and told David and said, I am with child. You know, sin has a way of growing, doesn't it? It's exactly what's happening here. David takes one look, a prolonged look, invites her over, has relations with her, and thinks, okay, you know, that should be the end of it. Suddenly, there's a child. Sin is beginning to grow. What started out as a little indulgence turns into a bit of a pickle now for David. And so David then, what does he do? He sent to Joab in verse 6, saying, send me Uriah the Hittite. And Joab sent Uriah to David. And when Uriah had come to him, David asked how Joab was doing and how the people were doing and how the war prospered. And so David, you know, he gets Uriah to come back now and he begins to engage in small talk. Hey, Uriah, how's the battle going? How's Joab been doing? Everything going well? Right on. All right. But we see David's intent in all this. What does he say in verse 8? He said to Uriah, go down to your house and wash your feet. So Uriah departed from the king's house, and a gift of food from the king followed him. You see, what David is doing is, instead of repenting, he's plotting. Right then and there, in this moment, he should have realized that things have gotten away on him. The fire is spreading. And the antidote is to confess and repent of your sin. But what does David want to do? He's wanting to cover up that sin. And this is his attempt here. This is the plot. This is the scheming that's going on. He's wanting to cover up his sin. So he brings Uriah back and is attempting to have Uriah go home and spend a night with his wife Bathsheba so that it would look like he's the one that got her pregnant. You know? And then they can go on Mori Povich and have their maternity test and find out who the real daddy is. That sort of a thing. That's kind of what's happening. And David now, he's pulling out all the stops. He says, go wash your feet. Get yourself freshened up. Put a little cologne on. Do something. And then he sends some food with him, you know. Saying, we'll just lay this out. You guys can have a nice intimate dinner. We'll get the candles going, you know. Put on a little bit of, you know, Marvin Gaye or something like that. And just get you guys in the mood. That sort of a thing, right? And that's kind of what David's intent is here. So that Uriah will have, you know, spend a night with his wife. And then so when it finds out that Bathsheba's pregnant, oh, Uriah, it was, remember when you came back from battle here and you had that night at home? That's it. That's when, you know, she got pregnant. So David's just simply looking to cover up his sin and his folly here. But things don't really go as according to plan here. Look at what happens in verse 9. Uriah slept at the door of the king's house with all the servants of his lord and did not go down to his house. So when they told David, saying, Uriah did not go down to his house, David said to Uriah, did you not come from a journey? Why did you not go down to your house? And Uriah said to David, the ark in Israel and Judah are dwelling in tents, and my lord Joab and the servants of my lord are encamped in the open field. Shall I then go to my house to eat and drink and to lie with my wife? As you live and as your soul lives, I will not do this thing. Uriah is one who doesn't feel deserving to go and have a night of comfort. He instead sleeps at the door of the king's house. Now this in and of itself has to be very convicting to David. You see, Uriah, he was a foreigner. He was a Hittite. The Bible's very clear on saying. He was one that basically was a convert and became kind of a follower with Israel and a follower of the God of Israel. He was a convert to this. He was a foreigner, but he comes in and he begins to be concerned. He's saying, you know, the ark and Israel and Judah, they're dwelling in tents. And my Lord Joab and the servants of my Lord, they're just out in the open fields. I can't go and take comfort when I know all these other people and all these other things are just sitting in tents or out in the open field. And I mean, here's David sitting here saying, oh, whoa, you know, here I am the king and I'm staying back from battle and I'm committing adultery with, you know, another man's wife. Boy, you know, this, and here's Uriah, just a foreigner who's more upright at this moment than David is. He's walking more in integrity than David the king is. I mean, that had to be kind of like a knife sort of getting thrust into David's gut here on this one. Uriah was definitely an honorable guy, while David was acting more of as a deplorable kind of a guy. But so David then attempts one more time to cover up his sin by having Uriah sleep with his wife. And so in verse 12, we see that David said to Uriah, wait here today also, and tomorrow I will let you depart. So Uriah remained in Jerusalem that day and the next. Now when David called him, he ate and drank before him, and he made him drunk. And at evening he went out to lie on his bed with the servants of his Lord, but he did not go down to his house. So here's David now, trying to cover up a sin by almost engaging in sin. He's trying to get Uriah drunk. He says, hey, Uriah, your glass is getting a little empty here. Let me fill that up for you. Hey, let me top that up for you. Oh, Uriah, that's only your sixth glass. Let me give you some more here, you know. And he's trying to get him drunk. And thinking that, you know, his integrity will just kind of be loosened up. And he'd be a lot more willing and free to go to his home and see his wife. Alcohol is a way of kind of doing that. This is what John Corson says about this. David sought to get Uriah drunk because he knew, as the devil does, that alcohol lowers the resistance of moral fortitude. I could tell you story after story of godly men and women who began toying with alcohol and found their spiritual lives eroding. You are a wise person if you realize the danger of alcohol and say, I have a hard enough time thinking right when I'm sober. I don't need to make it harder on myself. Bathsheba, Solomon's mother, would say in Proverbs 31, it is not for kings to drink wine or princes to drink strong drink. Let drink be given to those who are perishing and those that be of a depressed spirit. And he goes on to say, therefore, if you want to be a king or a prince, if you've discovered there's power in prayer and liberty in praise, you won't need the crutch of alcohol to get through a day or a situation. I think that's right on. I'll leave it at that. Let's look at verse 14. In the morning, it happened that David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it by the hand of Uriah. You know, with things not going according to plan now, David goes to option number two, murder. If I can't cover up this sin, then I'll just try to, you know, erase the problem here. And just take Uriah out of the picture. I mean, it just begins to get absurd at how sin is, again, just beginning to increase and compound itself. And what started off so small has grown into such a big mess. And sin has a way of doing that. It's like the leaven, which leaveneth the whole lump. It just takes a little bit to begin to permeate its way through the whole batch of dough. And this is what's happening in David's life, because he's not willing to repent and confess that sin. He's looking just to cover it up. And he's finding that as he's doing that, that sin, which has taken root, is just continuing to spread and compound itself. And so, in the morning, it happened that David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it by the hand of Uriah. And he wrote in the letter, saying, set Uriah in the forefront of the hottest battle and retreat from him that he may be struck down and die. So David's heart and intent is, Joab, Uriah's got to die. But let's make it look like, you know, he just died in battle. Let's make it look like it was an accident. I don't want to, you know, be blamed for this after all. So let's make it look like it just kind of happened. And Uriah, again, such an honorable guy that David has him carry his own death warrant to Joab. Here, Uriah, can you take this to Joab? Don't bother looking at it. It's just about my intent to have you killed. But just, you know, leave it alone, right? I mean, this is the kind of guy that Uriah was, and the sadly, the kind of guy that David was being right now. So, in verse 16, so it was while Joab besieged the city, that he assigned Uriah to a place where he knew there were valiant men. Then the men of the city came out and fought with Joab, and some of the people of the servants of David fell, and Uriah the Hittite died also. Then Joab sent and told David all the things concerning the war, and charged the messenger, saying, when you have finished telling the matters of the war to the king, if it happens that the king's wrath rises, and he says to you, why did you approach so near to the city when you fought? Did you not know that they would shoot from the wall? Who struck Abimelech, the son of that person, was it not a woman who cast a piece of a millstone on him from the wall so that he died in Thebes? Why did you go near the wall? Then you shall say your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead also. So Joab is saying, okay, sends a messenger to David to tell him what happened. Now what had happened was, first of all, Joab was just to kind of put Uriah out on the front lines, the fiercest part of the battle where Uriah would be taken down. It didn't quite happen that way. Uriah and other soldiers, other men, ended up dying. They got a little too close to the city, and so Joab begins to kind of explain that a little bit. And if David begins to get upset, thinking, you know, I just wanted Uriah dead. I didn't want all these other guys to die. Just explain to him, and he recites an example from Judges chapter 19 of this man Abimelech, who, again, he was a guy that was very prideful, and he went right up to the city, went right up to the wall of the city, ready to take it down, thinking he was just, you know, untouchable. And it was just a woman who was up on the city wall looking down saying, this guy's just, you know, a sitting turkey here, and just dropped the millstone right on him. And so Joab saying, just remind David that this has happened before in our history, just like at Judges 19, and then perhaps he will not be so angry here. But that's what happened. Uriah and some of the men got a little too close in coming against the people there of Ammon and Rabbah, and so several of them died. But David doesn't really care what happens as long as Uriah is out of the picture. And notice here what happens in verse 22. So the messenger went and came and told David all that Joab had sent by him. And the messenger said to David, surely the men prevailed against us and came out to us in the field. Then we drove them back as far as the entrance of the gate. And the archer shot from the wall at your servants, and some of the king's servants are dead, and your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead also. Now notice David, how he just kind of nonchalantly dismisses it. He says to the messenger, thus you shall say to Joab, do not let this thing displease you, for the sword devours one as well as another. That's, you know, just kind of what happens, you know. One person dies, by his sword another person dies. It's just all kind of in the name of war. That sort of a thing. He just kind of dismisses it. These things happen in battle. And not only is sin compounding, but David is becoming, you know, all the more calloused now in his attitude to sin. There's no sign of remorse at all at this point. You see, the more that we entertain sin and allow sin just to kind of take that root where we're not dealing with it, then the more that we do become numb and desensitized to it. Where suddenly those things that may have hurt us before aren't really that much of an issue. Those things that may have caused us to run in the past, you know, we find ourselves sticking around a little bit longer, becoming numb and desensitized to sin. And David, again, one who's not dealing with these things, is just kind of, oh, well, you know, that's the way it goes. And notice in verse 26, when the wife of Uriah heard that Uriah, her husband, was dead, she mourned for her husband. And when her mourning was over, David sent and brought her to his house, and she became his wife and bore him a son. But the thing that David had done displeased the Lord. You know, David thought, well, okay, Bathsheba's a widow now. She's, you know, going to be a single mom. I can't have that. I'll marry her. And surely when I do this, then people are going to go, oh, David, you're just such a swell guy. Here you are showing such grace to this widow, to this one who's going to be a single mother. Oh, David, you're just so awesome. He's thinking this is going to please everybody. But notice, it displeased the Lord, it says. And ultimately, that's who we are sinning against. I mean, it was Joseph who said to Potiphar's wife at that time, how then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? Joseph wasn't even concerned what that would do necessarily to him. I'm sure he was, but the issue wasn't, you know, could this affect me? Could this affect you? Could this affect your husband Potiphar? He said, no, this is sin against God. And this will affect my relationship with God because that's who I'd be sinning against. I wouldn't be sinning against you or your husband or me. It'd be against God. And that was enough for Joseph to say, I don't want to do that. I don't want anything to do with that. That's why Joseph was so quick to flee and to run. This was truly now, I think, a real agonizing time for David. He spent a long time in this period where he was just kind of covering up the sin, just sort of letting this eat away at him. And it's reflected in Psalm 32. Why don't you turn over there with me? Psalm 32. And we'll look at right at verse 1. Blessed is he whose transgression is forgiven, whose sin is covered. Blessed is the man to whom the Lord does not impute iniquity and in whose spirit there is no deceit. And this is the part here that I think we're dealing with right now in David's life. It says, when I kept silent, my bones grew old through my groaning all the day long. For day and night your hand was heavy upon me. My vitality was turned into the drought of summer. I acknowledged my sin to you, and my iniquity I have not hidden. I said, I will confess my transgressions to the Lord, and you forgave the iniquity of my sin. But notice that. He says, when I kept silent, my bones grew old. And my vitality was turned in the drought of summer. I just became weakened in that period. And so it is when we are harboring sin or bitterness or the like. It's going to have its toll on our lives. Physically, emotionally, spiritually. It's going to have an effect on us. But David says, when I confess, then you forgave the iniquity of my sin. And as much as we don't like to be convicted over something, we need to see it as God not necessarily wanting to leave us in that place that breeds misery. God doesn't want that for us. And so he brings that conviction to awaken us to our error and our sin so that we can come to that place of repentance. And it's exciting to see that God will not leave David in this state of sin. He wants to restore him. And we'll see that happening in the next chapter, which I'd really love to get into tonight. But I think we'll save it for next week. Let's do that, all right?